BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In the early 90s, a group of tech experts testified to the U.S. Senate to raise awareness of the fact that all computer users were in danger.
You gentlemen would come forward.
They weren't the heads of major tech companies or university researchers or even from the defense industry.
We're joined today by the seven members of the Loft Hacker Think Tank in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
They were hackers, often demonized as malicious criminals. They were fighting to expose the companies, putting people at risk.
They'll be using their hacker names of Mudge, Weld, Brian Oblivion, Kingpin.
Vulnerabilities in software were a pain in the ass to organizations that both ran the software and built the software. You know, they would like it if people just wouldn't look for them, right? Because if it was found, then they had to do something about it.
I hope my grandkids don't ask me who my witnesses were today and say space rogue.
I'm Gabriella Coleman, a professor of anthropology at Harvard, and this is The Hackers, a series that delves into the hidden histories of hacking and uncovers how it's shaped the world as we know it. In this episode, we're exploring the David and Goliath story of how ethical hackers took on the tech giants.
My name is Chris Weiss-Sopel.
Chris is also known as Weld Pond, his hacker handle that he still goes by on Twitter. An original member of The Loft, he's now a leading security expert. In its origins, hacking was a neutral, even positive term. But by the 80s and 90s, that had begun to change.
You know, it came out of people that were just exploring technology. But then it started to be thought of as a criminal activity to do hacking. And so people that were in this sphere wanted to separate black hat hacking and white hat hacking to divide the villains from the good guys.
The hat metaphor came directly from classic cowboy movies. But what ended up happening is that corporations started to usurp the term white hat. To be considered one of the good guys, you had to do things their way. If you deviated, like going to a hacker conference, you're one of the bad guys.
We didn't think the lines were drawn in the right places. So we invented this term, the gray hat.
Can you tell us what gray hat means?
Gray hat hacking is someone who is really focused on the facts. They're not trying to put any kind of ethical implications on an activity. They just want to focus on what are the facts of the situation? What is the vulnerability? What is a tool that exploits the vulnerability? And they think everyone should have access to this knowledge.
Knowledge can be a tricky thing, though, used for good or evil. And so sharing information, even with a positive mindset, could and did have severe consequences, especially for one hacker by the name of Dan Farmer. In the mid-90s, he and his partner, Vitzi Venema, set out to develop a method to test software for potential weaknesses.
They wrote a paper called Securing Your Network by Attacking It, or something like that. And the idea was if a hacker attacks your network, you learn from that. You built up this library of different attacks that you've learned from hackers, or you maybe in your lab, you've tried things out. If instead of letting attackers do it, you find out where the holes are and then fix them.
This hands-on imperative is a well-tested engineering methodology. But for the budding cybersecurity sector, this was completely new, and for some, an unsettling concept.
And then a few years later, they had the idea that they would write some software that would automate the idea of executing all these attacks on the network.
He called the software Satan, security administrator tool for analyzing networks.
And Dan Farmer knew Neil Gaiman and had Neil Gaiman draw him a logo for Satan, which was kind of this scary Satanish type character. And so Dan released this tool and he thought, people would love it.
Spoiler, they did not.
This was what we call a dual-use technology. It can be used for good, like you hack your networks you control, or it can be used for bad, where you hack someone else's network. And what happened with Dan was his company saw the bad side. He got fired.
These days, This kind of vulnerability scanner is a standard security tool. Developers have made billions off software that owes its existence to Satan. The hacker gets fired, tech companies make bank. What happened to Dan showed gray hats they were living in a dangerous world, so they tended to band together. You had groups or associations like The Loft, Cult of the Dead Cow, the Chaos Computer Club in Europe. There was safety in numbers, and with a lot of hacker brains working together, they were able to uncover many more vulnerabilities.
One of the early browsers was Internet Explorer. And what happens with a browser is, you know, you connect to another computer and it sends you data back, right? So it's a way for a remote computer to decide what input is coming to your computer. And that's exactly the kind of scenario where if you had a vulnerability, someone could control what is going to come to your computer. Dildog, who was a member of The Loft, found a vulnerability in Internet Explorer 4.0. He could send your computer a page that if you clicked on a link on the page, he could then take control of your computer. And what we did is we did a demo. There was like a warning page. It said, if you click on this link, your computer will crash.
So why didn't the gray hats just tell the software vendors like Microsoft what was wrong and ask them to fix it? Well, they did. At the time, companies would flat out deny that there were any vulnerabilities in their code. Companies, in fact, blame hackers for any problems they found.
You would say, hack your own products, right? Why aren't you doing the kind of stuff that we are doing? And so to get those points across, one of the early methods was called full disclosure, where in order to really get people to wake up to the problem, you would just publish your research without informing the vendor, or at the same time you informed the vendor. And essentially what happens is everyone who uses the technology now knows they're vulnerable and there's little they can do about it.
Full disclosure was wildly controversial. Some people supported it. Obviously the companies did not. And some in the security and hacker communities felt too much was being published. But there was a method in the madness. It was making trouble to make a point.
Tech companies are very slow to change, right? And a lot of software was just riddled with these vulnerabilities. It was almost too scary to think about. Well, they were going to have to change and invest a lot more in securing their software. It was going to cost them money. So there was a huge resistance, and it went on for years. Companies knew about this problem in the mid-90s, and we didn't see Microsoft really start to take this seriously till around 2001.
Hacker groups went on the offensive. Along with publishing vulnerabilities, they built tools that could easily break or crack software. The Loft tool, LoftCrack, showed people how easily someone could take control of any given computer. The Cult of the Dead Cow had a similar tool called BackOrifice. More and more was being exposed. The mounting pressure shook companies enough to take action. Tech company employees and government officials, even the feds, started sneaking into hacker conferences, trying to work out the secrets.
So the environment was kind of ripe for this kind of crossover and exchange of ideas between these two communities, which before that, it was just sort of shouting at each other in the press.
An intimate meeting was arranged between hackers and the suits at a restaurant in Las Vegas. It became known simply as the dinner.
But the dinner was really where a few executives, you know, Steve Lipner, one of the executives at Microsoft, and this guy, Yobi Benjamin, I think he was at Ernst & Young at the time, kind of brokered the deal. He knew the guys at Microsoft and he knew the people at The Loft. So it was Mudge and Hobbit from The Loft. And Hobbit especially was doing some really interesting research at the time around Microsoft's file sharing protocols. And he was finding all these ways of, you know, basically exploiting it. So like you could read files you weren't supposed to, right? And at this dinner, Hobbit basically explained to the people at Microsoft, you know, what was his process? How did he do this? And they were just dumbfounded that this was even possible. Now, it still took years for them to take action, but I think that dinner really was when the light bulb went off at Microsoft. And I think part of it was de-boogeymanning the hacker.
The dinner helped with the suits, but for the public, the tools the gray hats had created was what really stuck.
People could actually see with their own eyes how easy it was to crack a password. It made the abstract world of hacking much more tangible. And I think Back Orifice was the same way. You know, Back Orifice really woke people up to the idea that if someone could get you to run their Trojan software, they could take control of your computer. And Back Orifice demonstrated all the different things that they could do. They could turn on your camera, your microphone, and of course it could capture your keystrokes and capture your screen. And it made it very clear the danger everyone was all in.
Companies began to change, and so too did the gray hats. The shock tactic of full disclosure had served its initial purpose. And not long after, these two factions met in the middle and came up with coordinated disclosure.
We actually got a message from Microsoft after we published that Internet Explorer 4 exploit. When we published that, it was such a huge sort of devastating problem for them. They actually reached out to us. It was Scott Culp at Microsoft who ran the Microsoft Security Response Center. And he came to us and said, you know, if you were willing to tell us about the vulnerability before you release it publicly, we will commit to fixing it. And then, you know, we don't care. You can then publish what you want, but please give us a chance to fix it. It will keep our users safer. So that was the sort of the beginning is like, well, if they're going to commit to actually fixing it in a reasonable amount of time, and we can still publish what we want to publish, then doesn't that seem like it's a good balance of getting it fixed, making users aware of it, but also sort of protecting them during this period of time when the vulnerability is known to some people, but there's no fix available?
This became an established approach, and it meant the users had a greater degree of protection, while black hats had to work a bit harder to hunt for vulnerabilities to do harm. It was a victory after a long fight. But there was something of a catch-22. The gray hats championed security, and many of them, like Chris, went on to create the security industry as we know it today. But in so doing, the gray hat groups began to fade away.
I don't think it's as important now as it was in the past, but occasionally you'll get an ignorant organization, or for one reason or another, an organization that is just upset about something. And so I think in certain cases, the gray hat release, the gray hat drop that doesn't really care about the harm caused can, you know, still be effective and it still has a place. But I actually don't think it's as necessary anymore because hackers are everywhere, right? Like the people with the hacker mindset are at these companies and the voice is part of the discussion inside even a government organization. We've sort of subverted the dominant paradigm, I think was one of the phrases that activists used to use. We've infiltrated the organization, so the mindset is already there.
The original gray hats may have won their fights and indeed are now in the driving seat in many instances. But this was in a world before social media, and the online landscape is very different today. There's still actors who hide risks, who keep us in the dark, and hope we don't ask too much about what's being done to our data. So we will always need those who are willing to make some trouble to make a point. When the next generation of gray hats steps forward, they may again be demonized, but we will still need them to bring things into the light.
Hi, I'm John Ronson, and I want to tell you about a new podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4. It's called Things Fell Apart. If you've ever yelled at someone on social media about, say, cancel culture or mask wearing, then you are a soldier in the culture wars, those everyday battles for dominance between conflicting values. I was curious to learn how things fell apart, and so I decided to go back in history and find the origin stories.
There was this ping, and there was a bullet flying around the house.
I had no idea, but I've uncovered some extraordinary people and the strangest, most consequential tales. Subscribe now to Things Fell Apart on BBC Sounds.